Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thanks very much. It's been a great meeting so far, and I think especially the previous two talks are wonderfully fit into what I want to talk about. My interest has over basically almost throughout my career been to try to understand this question: how do variants in the genome determine phenotype? And originally, this was basically done by looking at disease phenotypes. So you have major mutations in the genome, and then try to see what is the outcome in terms of phenotype. But of course, this is also something that has to do with human variability of phenotypes. And more recently, we then moved into evolution, because there, as you have already seen in the last talks, you have the most fantastic different phenotypes. And I think with the technologies that they are now today, one can start elucidating how variants actually produce different traits and phenotypes. It's something that I think a couple of years ago was not possible. So if we look at where the variants are, and funny, I also alluded on that already, then we have, of course, the small protein coding part. And interestingly, if you look at human mutations, and that has not much changed since we can now sequence whole genomes, the great, great majority of all mutations are within the coding genome. So these have major effects that cause monogenic disease. Then we have genetic evidence for human variation. From GWAS studies, for example, they're almost all of them are in the non-coding genome, so it's regulation. And now the question is, what could the variation do in terms of evolution as species? And it's been mentioned before by Hendrik and also others now, is that the non-coding variants are likely to be major drivers of phenotypic diversity. And that's what I want to study and elude on. So the phenotype that we look at is, I think, one of the most striking phenotypic adaptations that you can think of. It's how mammals actually learn to fly, and the adaptation of a limb, particularly a hand, to a wing. So that's what we look at, and we try to find out what are the key genes and also regulatory elements that produce this phenotype. So what are the major anatomical features of the bat wing? Well, first of all, of course, it's the wing membrane, as you can see here. It's called the chiropatagium, and then there are also other patagiums here at the side and at the tail, but we talk about mainly the chiropatagium. And then you have these massive elongation of digits that you can see here. Mainly, it's the third, fourth, and fifth that are elongated, and this is an old paper from 2008, and you can see here a bone and the growth plate of a metacarpal and a digit versus the metacarpal and the phalanx of the hind limb, which is more or less like a normal digit, and these are these massive elongations that they have, right? So I measured this for the fun. I have at home sort of a little bat skeleton, and to measure the carpal bone to the digit, it would actually be, compared to my size, 1.5 meters long. And then the students say, that's nice. You can scratch your back without any problem. That's true. You just imagine it would be sort of a bone that is basically that long. So that's pretty amazing. And we thought, well, such a drastic phenotype, we have to try to find out how this works. So just one word to the model system LIMP, which we've been studying for a long time now. Basically, the developing limb is controlled by a three-dimensional coordinate system, one would say, of something of messenger molecules that control this anterior posterior, which is from your small finger to your thumb, the dorsal ventral, which is the back of your hand, versus the palm, and the proximal distal, which is basically from your shoulder to your digits. Now, the proximal distal is something that is of interest and that we studied further in that context. That's why I just want to mention these, that in this proximal distance, Distel thinks we have a gradient expression of Hox genes. So we again with the Hox genes, with the high number expressed distally and the low number expressed more proximally, which you can also see here in these in situs. And then there is another marker, and Fanny mentioned that also already, it's the Shox gene, which is basically expressed only in humerus and radius ulna, but not in the otopod, so the digits and the metacarpals. So what Fanny and Magda and Christian did in this initial study is that they collected embryos because we want to look at the time point and the gene expression when this develops and when the wing forms. And of course, you have to do that then in embryos and in the embryonic stages where this actually happens. That was a difficult task to get these embryos. And also, you may know, or maybe not, that bats have only one embryo, which makes the whole thing also more complicated. Anyway, what they managed to do is to get these samples and compare them to the mouse. And Chris did the analysis of single cells prepared from these different stages. And basically, you put all these single cells together of mouse and bat and forelimb and hindlimb and get these kind of clusters. And the one maybe surprising thing was that there is actually not much of a difference. So what Fanny mentioned is that there is a cluster that pops out that you would think there must be a cluster of cells that is specific to the bat forelimb. Doesn't exist. It all looks very much alike. And that you can see here again in this comparison. There are also these interdigital cells that are basically the same. So we find all the clusters in the mouse that we find also in the bat. And if you align them all, you see there's a very high similarity. So that was kind of disappointing. But what they then did is that they microdissected the chiropatagium, so the wing membrane from an embryo. And then we did a single cell of these and mapped these cells back onto the cluster. And on the entire clusters. And then we basically found the cells in these clusters that you see here. And we also saw that these interdigital cells, which previously had been thought that they transform into the wing membrane, actually have a very low contribution to these chiropatagium cells. Instead, it's basically fibroblastic cells, and that's why we didn't find them in the beginning. There's one marker gene that pops up, and this is the transcription factor MICE2, which was sort of the most upregulated gene in these specific fibroblastic-like cells. And that's what we investigated further. And what Chris then did is that he basically separated the proximal from the distal cells in the single cell. And you could do that with these marker genes of Hox and Shox, for example. And that's what you see here in the mouse and in the bat forelimb and in the bat hindlimb. And the distal ones actually have this additional cluster here that we've been searching for. And now you see this cluster of cells that are specific and that will develop then later on in development into these wing membranes. So we looked at these. And then we see again the transcription factor MICE2. Which pops up, and there is another transcription factor here, TBX3, that was of interest to us, and we also investigated them further, but to make a long story short, that is the major genes that we found, and we also did these beautiful HDR in situs that Fanny has shown, and then you can see here in this magenta that mice is indeed expressed entirely in these interdigital cells, in these wing membrane cells, and the TBX transcription factor actually forms sort of it's almost like an AER structure at the end of these of this wing membrane, where it's also co-expressed with mice too. So these are apparently key factors that are involved, and we also tested them by overexpression in mice, which I don't want to talk about now, but there we do get some effects in terms of digit development that look like a bat. So on the second part of the project, we now looked at the later stage. So I've showed you before, you have the development of the wing membrane, but then you have an elongation of digits that actually happens at a slightly later stage when they start growing like wild. So what we did is that we basically took of a later stage only these autopod cells, so the digits and the metacarpals, and cut them here at the wrist, and then made a single cell suspension and sequencing out of these. And then you get, of course, a very different picture than to the early ones, because now these cells have differentiated. You find chondrocytes, you find bone cells, you find tendon-like cells, and so on, because it's, you know, it's a very differentiated tissue. And then we compared forelimb to hind limb, and you see here the hind limb is very tiny. It just looks more or less like a normal foot, whereas you have these massively elongated digits in the first. So this is what Chris then compared. And we look at then forelimb versus hind limb, and here you see in the dark magenta versus the light magenta, forelimb versus hind limb, and you see there are many more forelimb cells in this part here, which actually represents the fibroblastic wing membrane cells. The other ones look relatively similar, also in the distribution. And if we then look at the regulated genes in these clusters, we find our old friend, MICE2, which pops up here. But now we are interested in these ones here, so the chondrocytes and the bone cells and all these. So what do we find there? And that was a bit more surprising, because what we now find is a lot of HOX genes and HOXD4, which I told you at the beginning was actually a gene that is more associated with the more proximal part of the limb and not the distal. And there's another very interesting candidate, which is SHOX. And these two are the ones that really pop out here with a couple of other HOX genes together. So if we then look at where they are expressed, then the SHOX is in its own kind of cluster, which is perichondrium cells. So these are the cells that surround the cartilage and that actually give the signals into the cartilage cells to grow and also to make bone. So this is where SHOX is, and this is where HOXD4 is. So it's within this cluster, but also in a couple of other cells, in the tendon cells and in the chondrocytic, in the cells here, down here, but not in the wing membrane. So it strongly overlaps, but not totally. So then we did another HCR, and here you see the forelimb with its wing membranes and the digits, and the hind limb with its five digits. So let's see if this works. Yeah. So you see in magenta SHOX and in yellow HOXD. And I think you can very nicely appreciate that it's expressed here in radius and ulna and in the metacarpals. Whereas in the hind limb, the SHOX is only expressed here in the distal ulna or radius, whatever this is here. And the HOX is in some tendon cells, and there's basically nothing here distally. And here, HOXD4, you have in the digits. There's another kind of cool thing. If you look at digit 1, which is completely negative for the SHOX, whereas all the other ones that have these elongation are positive, because the digit 1 is the one that stays very small and short in the bat. It just is a, if you want, a normal size digit. So we see quite a massive expansion. Radius ulna, the metacarpals, and the phalanges. So what my current hypothesis sort of to this whole thing is that you actually get a shift of expression of transcription factors that encode a certain bone type. And what you always have in the limb is that you basically have the information long, long, short, right? And this kind of information is, I think, mainly conferred by the expression of these HOX genes, but also by SHOX. SHOX is one of the most frequent genes in human genetics associated with short stature. It's on the X chromosome, and deletions result in short stature. And if you have a homozygous mutation in SHOX, then you have a massively reduced radius and ulna, but the hands are basically normal. Well, and for TBX, this is the other candidate where we also have mutations where it's a short ulna, which TBX is also more proximally expressed than distally. So it could be that sort of the bone identity gets changed from short into long. So that's the current working hypothesis. So where are the regulatory domains? And now we look at the TATs again that Fanny showed. And the interesting thing about this TBX3 locus is that it's right to TBX5. And TBX5 is one of the very few genes, actually probably the only one, that is forelimb specific. It's expressed only in the forelimb, but not in the hind limb. So if we then look at the same situation in the bat, then we see here's the TBX3 TAT, the TBX5 TAT looks all very conserved, but we see a few more contact points between this TBX3 and the TBX5 TAT. So one hypothesis is that there is more contact from the forelimb specific regulatory site to the TBX3, and by that, TBX3 gets more forelimb expression. That was our hypothesis. And here you see a 4C that also, Fanny mentioned how this works, and you see that from TBX3 viewpoint, for example, we have more contact into the TBX5 landscape than in the mouse. So that would be a possibility. But these regions are gigantic, right? This is more than a megabase. And how could one ever test this? And then we looked at this, and what we would like to exchange is, first of all, this boundary region, which is about 50 kilobases, and then probably also the gene body of TBX5, which is another 100 kilobases. So the technology to do this, and this is what we've been building up over the last couple of years, really, it's a longer process, is that we combine, on one hand, the synthesis of these large fragments with a site-specific integration. So what does synthesis then here mean? It just means that you can now, and this has been basically done in yeast and developed in yeast, is that you can stitch together fragments that you have produced either by PCR or also by synthetic sequences. You have these fragments that can be between 3 and 5 kb long, and put them into yeast and by homologous recombination in these special fragments here. The yeast actually puts these all together and assembles them into one piece. This is a yeast artificial chromosome, but that also has a bacterial artificial backbone, and then you can take them from the yeast into bacteria and actually have a back with your desired sequence. That works amazingly well, one has to say, and the size limit maybe is around 150 kb or so, where you can actually produce sequence from scratch. And of course, you can design them also in any way that you want. We also do that in a different project, but for this one, we basically take the bat sequence because most of them, we don't have backs, so we have to produce them ourselves. So that's the first problem. The second problem, and this is actually the more complicated problem, you want to put this sequence into the mouse and actually exchange the mouse sequence with the bat sequence. Huh? So here in the schematic, you have a gene, you have your regulatory sequence, and you basically want to exchange this for the bat. So how we do this now is you first have to insert a landing pad here upstream, and then you can insert the synthetic sequence, and then you basically have a mouse-bat chimera that you can then investigate for phenotype or gene expression. So that's the idea. How do we do this? We have basically developed two technologies to do that, and one which is working quite well for this purpose was actually developed in the Boecker lab in New York, and we've been collaborating with them. So in a nutshell, it's a more complicated, sophisticated CRISPR strategy that relies on sort of double selection markers and a landing pad that you can that you put in here. And these, without going into detail, these double selective markers are then in this one cassette, but also in a second cassette, which is your construct. And the construct contains the cargo, it contains homology arms, and it contains so-called UGTs, so these are unique cutters for CRISPR. And then you have assemble all this in yeast, and now you cut with your UGT on this side, because this marker cassette also has a UGT, you cut on the specific other side where you want to replace it. And then you cut the back here and here in the cells, and then by homologous recombination, this sequence is actually inserted into the mouse genome, and the mouse genome is replaced by the bat sequence. And then you have basically the MC2 cassette, which gives you the resistance for this. So you end up then with the sequence in here and the MC2 cassette. You can cut this out, and then you more or less have a more or less scarless insertion of the sequence. What you can also do, you can continue from this MC2 cassette and then have another construct that again has the MC1 cassette, and then put in the second one, theoretically the third one, and so on, right? And by that, you can replace relatively large pieces. We cannot replace tats of a megabase, but so 100, 200K is possible with this. So, and then you have to cut out the MC1 cassette, and then you have, now you have the TBX boundary with 50K and the gene body with 100K. And then you have to sequence this. The sequencing was actually another major problem, because if you have these large inserts, there are all sorts of things that can happen. So the only way to genotype them properly is by long-read sequencing and Oxford nanopore. And then you get these sequences and you get the match, and you can see exactly whether your piece is in there or not. And then from these clones, we make mice. Yeah. I would say that's a pretty unique setup. There are not many labs that can do this. And that's what we did. So let's look at the outcome, which sort of as a teaser at the beginning is less spectacular than one may think, but anyway. So we replaced the TBX gene body and the boundary, and then we look at gene expression, we look at ATAC, and we look at 27-acetyl, a marker for activating enhancers and promoters. And you see here the mouse allele versus the bat allele. This is where the transcription starts, and you see here in the bat there's more activity here upstream. And if we look at then in the mouse allele, in the mouse with the bat allele, you see that there is also more activity here compared to the mouse. So there is something going on, but in principle, it works perfectly fine, and the bat allele works totally fine in the mouse. We then look at gene expression. This is all in the heterozygous. So we can then nicely compare the wild-type mouse allele versus the bat allele and compare these two expressions. And you see that the bat is a bit more, it's significant, but not a lot, more expressed in the forelimb compared to the mouse. So there is an effect. We have a number of genes that get regulated. And if we look at these, then there is quite a few muscle genes in there, and TBX has been known to be involved in muscle development. And if we compare these with our TBX3 overexpression mice, we have mice where we overexpressed TBX with under a different promoter. you see that also these have muscle muscle genes. There's no phenotype so far. We are waiting for the homozygous mice because these have been bred, and then we will see what happens. So the second locus that I want to talk to about, and it's again Hox, and it's sort of also, I mean, a kind of a to Danny DeBoult's work, but one has to say these are the genes that pop up, not been chosen to be presented here, but because they are so important and they apparently pop up and have a role. So what Denny showed is that there are two TATs left and right of this cluster, and Fanny has just mentioned it. So the one on the right, the TDOM, is apparently for the early activation. The late distal one is on the left, the CDOM, and this is basically the cluster that you see here. And that also somehow reflects the proximal distal distribution of gene expression in the limb, but of course also in the body from cranial to caudal. So this is the serial activation and repression of Hox genes. So if we look at the Hox genes in the bat, then there is actually, and these are bulk data now, there is actually sort of interesting things happening, because you see here in the mouse forelimb, and this is a logarithmic scale, you see very low, and then it sort of slightly declines, and the highest, of course, are 13 and 12. So this is only distal. This is only the hand, the autopod. The bat has a different distribution in the forelimb, right? You see that especially this D4 that we also found is much higher, almost as high as these ones. So it goes up, and then it stays more or less the same. In the hind limb, it looks quite different. We also have this slight, this elevation of D4, but then the other ones actually drop and are expressed less. So there is something going on here, which is interesting. And this has been done by comparing these reference genomes by Anna Monaco. So what we do now is that we compare the regulatory landscapes. And basically, this is done now by a method where you take different chromatin modifications, and it gives you then these scores, and by these, you know, blue peaks, you basically see the activity. Forelimb versus hindlimb. And in the TATs, in the mouse, you basically see there's no difference. It's totally the same. In the bat, if we look at the different TATs, there's also not much of a difference, looks very similar. But here, you see, in the cluster, there seems to be a major difference. So we zoom in here, and this is what we see. So in the mouse, you see forelimb, hindlimb, the same. In the bat, we have this region here, which we call this prox element, which has a massive acetylation in the bat forelimb, but not in the hindlimb. And then you have this activity throughout, which extends further than in the mouse. And in the hind limb, it sort of goes down. So this kind of corresponds to what you see in the gene expression. So there are major regulatory events happening here. And that prompted us to basically ask the question, is it now possible to exchange the entire cluster? The entire cluster from this prox element until D1 is about 170 kilobases. Yeah? And this is what Sylvia did. So she basically produced this cluster in silico and then replaced it with that technology that I just showed you before. So we now have the entire Hox cluster in the mouse in one allele with a bat sequence. Yeah? And now we do the same game. We look at gene expression and we look at the 27 acetylation. And here you see the mouse allele, forelimb, hindlimb, and the bat allele, forelimb, hindlimb, and this is the endogenous bat forelimb, hindlimb. Now, what you can see is that you don't see much. The differences are basically, so what happens and what it looks like is that the bat allele is expressed in the mouse like a mouse allele. It doesn't care whether that it's a bat. And what Anna also did is that she looked at this in more detail, and she actually compared sequences that you can align and that are similar, and then looked for the 27 acetyl in the bat allele versus the mouse allele. And that's the quantification that she did for this. And here you see that again. And you see there's actually not much happening. There is a bit of variation, but we cannot recapitulate what happens in the bat. In spite of having the entire regulatory sequence in there and everything exchanged. So there must be other factors, and we are investigating these. So one is possibly mice too. So there must be transfectors that do this. But the other amazing thing here, I think, is that this allele functions in the mouse that has probably evolved some 60 million years ago. This is one of the earliest fossils that has been found of something that looks very much like a bat. So these animals could fly, and this gigantic time in between, the regulatory sequence works perfectly. Also, gene expression is perfectly there and basically not changed. So it just shows you what is technically possible, but also how difficult it is to actually find these regions. And my current concept is, how can you explain all of this? One thing is that if we look at the genome, I think the genes, only 20,000 genes, these are, it's like a toolbox. The genome is like a toolbox. And you take these 20,000 genes and look, use them again and again for different purposes and in different combinations, right? And for our LIMP model, it's basically a set number of tools. If you want to change this, you just change the order and the intensity, but you do not put any new genes in there. Right? You would have thought that maybe there's a new gene that gets expressed in the LIMP to produce this dramatic phenotype. No. It just seems to be the same thing that has been that is used over and over again to then achieve different outcomes. And it's basically just a fine-tuning of these elements. In this case, I think it's a fine-tuning of this distal versus proximal identity. And that's what we are looking after now. So we are also exchanging other whole landscapes. For example, a good candidate, I think, is the SHOX gene. And this is what we are currently doing. So you see, it's complicated. We haven't so far succeeded to make a flying mouse. And we just heard that AI can do anything. So I asked AI, make me a flying mouse, no problem. But you also see what AI hasn't understood, right? So, it's flying, but it is evolutionary not quite correct. So this is the team. I just mentioned Fanny. She has really been sort of the driving force behind all these the entire BAT project and the entire sample preparation, the ideas that we had and the concepts. So this is all basically hers. And Sylvia did a lot of these, the replacement of the HOX cluster, and Chris the bioinformatics, and Anna also the bioinformatics for these allele comparisons. And that's the entire group. And with that, I'm done. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.